Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the lead up to and early days of the American Revolution at a level of detail you may never have heard before. We'll spend this hour with historian Rick Atkinson. He's just out with the first volume of a planned trilogy on the War for Independence, and in addition to detailing the grand declarations and epic battles, Atkinson has a keen eye for fascinating human-scale stuff. The challenges of feeding giant armies before modern agriculture, transportation, or technology, the what-were-they-thinking medieval holdout medicines doctors used to treat bullet wounds, and why there is no chance that Paul Revere shouted, "The British are coming," on his midnight ride. Our conversation starts after a short break. There's a kind of romance to our American origin story. Brave and brilliant revolutionaries decide they can no longer tolerate tyranny. They take on the enormous, well-resourced juggernauts of the British Army and Navy and proceed to invent and install a bold new form of democracy that would serve as a model for much of the world. But let's be real here. For all the ways the story has been polished, punched up, and heavily edited over the centuries, the shorthand version of the American Revolution might as well have come from a Hollywood script doctor. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What's left out, you ask? Well, for one thing, we don't talk about how hard it was to get troops from different colonies working together, or about the great George Washington's early tactical mistakes as a military commander, or about the fact that we lost more soldiers to smallpox, malaria, and dysentery than battle wounds. Then there's the whole invasion of Canada incident we don't talk much about. Fortunately, the details that complicate this familiar story make it all the more fascinating. Historian Rick Atkinson is a former senior editor at The Washington Post. His new book, the first part of a planned trilogy, is called The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. Rick, welcome to Think.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I appreciate being here.
So it's remarkable to think that George III not only had never been to the colonies that he was in charge of, but he literally never left English soil.
It is astonishing, isn't it? He lived a long life. He became king in 1760 at the age of 22. He lived until 1820, and he never left England. He never even went to Scotland. And it really constricted his view of what his empire was like, particularly the perimeter of it, the far rim of it in places like America.
He was a smart guy. What were his chief misunderstandings about the colonies?
He was a smart guy, and he had broad interests from agronomy to astronomy. He was a great collector. He was a good father. He had 15 kids with the princess he married, Charlotte. You know, he had three serious strategic misconceptions, I think, that he shared with his primary ministers. One was that a majority of the American colonists remained loyal to the crown, that they may be secretly loyal, but in fact that they would come out and support the crown when the opportunity arose and the British army arrived to try to suppress the insurrection that began in 1775. The second misconception he makes is that force, including gunplay, if necessary, will chastise the obstreperous and will suppress the rebellion. And then the third, in some ways I think most interesting of the misconceptions, is he believes, and he believes it virtually through the entire 8 years of the Revolution, that if the American colonies are permitted to slip away, if they slip the chains of the empire, that it will be the beginning of the end for the British Empire, that then Ireland will rebel, and then the Sugar Islands in the West Indies, and then Canada, and then India. And the consequence will be, he believes, the end of an empire that is relatively new. It was created in 1763 with British victory in the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War as we know it. And he's determined that he is not going to preside over a diminishing empire. It's a version, really, of the domino theory mm-hmm. that propelled us into Vietnam two centuries later.
Was it a reasonable thing? We know it didn't happen that way, but was it a reasonable thing to worry about?
It's not stupid. It is definitely a reasonable thing to worry about. The notion of insurrections popping up around the empire is very threatening to them. The empire has been constructed on a mercantile premise that colonies exist to provide raw products to the mother country and then to buy the finished products that are made from those raw products. And if you begin to see that dissolve, it badly damages potentially the British economy. It undermines the basis of wealth for Britain, and it undermines its status in the world. They're always worried in Britain about the French in particular. They've already fought three wars in the 18th century against them. They're always looking over their shoulder at the French, and at heart there's a concern that if you allow any diminishing of the empire, the French will fill the void, take advantage of it, and it will imperil the British empire that is really coming into its own in 1775. The phrase "the sun never sets on the British Empire" was coined in 1773, which gives you an idea of how they're feeling about themselves.
What did loyalty look like among American colonists who continued to revere the crown? Did they have a thoroughly British identity or an American identity with an asterisk or something else?
Yeah, it's a shifting concept. It's kind of slippery. You might be loyal when the British Army is in your backyard and you're wearing a red ribbon in your hat and you're professing eternal fidelity to the king. But when those British troops leave and your rebel neighbors come over and start thumping your chest with their finger and accuse you of being against the cause, then you might be less loyal. And that makes it hard to generalize about them. But, you know, for a long time, Americans believed that one-third of the 2 million whites who lived in America in 1775, say, were loyal to the crown. One-third were kind of neutral, wanted to stay out of the fray, and one-third were really rebels, or if not radicals. And that's probably not true. We now think, modern scholarship suggests, that 18 to 20% were loyal, real loyalists. And again, this goes back to a misconception that the British government has. If it's only a fifth or less of the colonists who are loyal or potentially loyal, that's not enough of a critical mass to really participate in suppressing this insurrection. And it becomes a problem for them.
So this book made me think about a lot of things that I probably should have known but hadn't considered in this context before. And one is the conversion of the attitude of someone like Benjamin Franklin, who started his life as an Anglophile, a devoted English subject.
Yeah. Yeah, the king has no better subject than Benjamin Franklin. He is on vacation on the continent of Europe when George becomes king, and he comes back. He cuts his touring short to come back for the coronation, and he is devoted to him. And he writes about how loyal he is, and how the Americans should recognize that they are part of a great endeavor that is the British Empire. And he yammers on about this for quite some time. And then over time, really beginning in the early 1770s, he becomes increasingly radicalized. He's put upon by what the British are doing in the colonies, by imposing taxes without proper representation, famously, by leaving British Army regiments as an occupation force, and by generally treating the colonists as second, if not third-rate citizens. And it all comes to a head, really, in 1774, when Franklin is involved in an unfortunate episode where he shows rare bad judgment, actually. There's some purloined letters from the royal governor in Massachusetts, and they're damning. They talk in disparaging terms about American self-governance and so on. And they come to Franklin. It's not clear exactly how, but
it's like WikiLeaks.
It is kind of like WikiLeaks. It is exactly like that. And he intends that they not be published, but he sends them back to the rebels in Massachusetts, and of course they immediately publish them. It's a big scandal in London. He's dragged in front of the Privy Council. And rebuked publicly in a really shaming way, publicly shaming him, and this completes his radicalization. It's the most humiliating moment of his life, and it really turns and finishes turning him. He will sail back to America in the spring of 1775, almost a regicide, ready to kill his king. So you've seen him turn 180 degrees, and when he arrives in Philadelphia on that voyage back home, he finds that the war has actually started with Lexington and Concord.
And Franklin was a bad enemy to make because he had a great deal of influence within the media.
he had that. He's the most famous American in the world. He is close to being the most famous British subject in the world as a consequence of his extraordinary scientific discoveries, particularly relating to electricity. It has really, pardon the pun, electrified the world. And Franklin, as a great self-promoter, he is extremely good at playing up the simple American. When he arrives in France later in the war, they assume because he's coming from Philadelphia that he's a Quaker. He's not, but he lets them think that because it's useful to him. And not only is he adept at manipulating the media and using it, or the press at that time, using it to his own ends and to the ends of the American cause, he's the greatest diplomat we've ever had. He's the father of American diplomacy, and we will see him throughout the war exercising his extraordinary diplomatic skills.
All right, just to jump back for a moment here, the British Parliament passes this series of measures in 1774 known as the Coercive Acts in England, the Intolerable Acts here, followed by the Quebec Act. How did those measures convert even more loyalists or those people in the middle to the resistance?
Yeah, I mean, there were a sequence of events. There's the Boston Massacre, which is, unfortunate gunplay in the streets of Boston where a mob is fired on and several Americans are killed. And then in December 1773, there's the Boston Tea Party where the king and his government have insisted that a small tax remain on tea, partly as an effort to prop up the British East India Company, which is going bankrupt, partly as an effort to show that Parliament is still in charge. It's a token measure. But the Americans in Boston famously react by marching down to the ship that's full of tea, very expensive shipment of tea, and tossing it into Boston Harbor. It so enrages the British government that they pass this sequence of measures that we know as the Intolerable Acts. And the most hurtful of them is it closes Boston Harbor. Mm-hmm. Until the rebels are going to pay for that tea that they have ruined, they're not going to be able to bring anything in or ship anything out of Boston. Well, and it's coupled with, by chance, the Quebec Act, which Canada has become a British territory as a consequence of victory in the Seven Years' War. And it's actually a quite progressive measure. It allows French Catholics to have some rights and to participate in their own government. And it's pretty far-seeing. New Englanders hate French Catholics. They've been fighting them for 150 years along the border, and this further inflames them. So this combination of events that happens in a fairly short period of time really takes what has been a simmering insurrection and turns it into a rebellion. And this will lead up to the events of April 1775, when then the rebellion becomes a revolution.
Shot heard around the world.
Shot heard around the world, although it should be noted that firearms were so inaccurate. Muskets beyond 50 yards were very inaccurate and hopeless beyond 100 yards. So the shot heard around the world probably missed.
What changed? I mean, we had been skirmishing and fighting fully before the Declaration of Independence. What did that document and that formal declaration change?
Well, the Declaration famously is promulgated on July 4th, 1776. Thomas Jefferson writes the draft. Congress, sitting as a group of editors, tears his draft apart. They shorten it by a third. It must be said they make it much better. Jefferson is a fine stylist, but everybody needs editing. And when it comes out, it sets off celebration and huzzas, and there are fireworks, and there's drunken revelry up and down the 13 colonies. It gives George Washington, who's in New York at the time, and he has the Declaration read to all of his regiments in New York. You can just see soldiers shifting from foot to foot as they hear this droning on, the complaints against the British mother country. It gives Washington an opportunity to rally around a stated set of principles and causes. That's important.
My guest is historian Rick Atkinson, former senior editor at The Washington Post. His latest book is The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. If you'd like to join us, we've got lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can find us on Twitter at KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with historian Rick Atkinson about his new book, The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. Just for the record, Rick, how did the taxation of the colonies, I know that wasn't the only thing that they were rebelling over, but how did that compare with what was happening domestically in Britain?
Well, the taxes that the British government were asking the colonists to pay were a small pittance of what Britons typically paid. I mean, you're talking about a 25-to-1 ratio. So it's really pennies on the dollar, or, you know, it's pence on the shillings. Mm-hmm. And it's not the money so much. It's the principle. And the principle derives from the fact that the colonists, for the most part, have been left alone for 150 years. There's very little intervention. It's benign neglect by the mother country. And then they come in and they're imposing a military occupation with regiments that are initially along the frontier, but then are in Boston. And they're asking for the colonists to participate in helping to defray the cost, the enormous costs of the Seven Years' War, partly because the British argument goes, you know, you benefited from it. We provided protection against the French and the Indians out of Canada, and so why shouldn't you pay for some of this? But they have no voice in it. They don't have representation in Parliament. They don't have good representation at all. And this rankles them because they're accustomed to self-governance by this time. They've got their own provincial assemblies. They've got their own, township assemblies and so on. And, you know, there are a number of other grievances that they've got. But this from Massachusetts on down to Georgia, this is something that they really find they cannot palate. They want the king to understand that if they're going to be taxed, they must have a voice in what that taxation is going to be about and how much it will be. And Parliament and the king are just not interested in giving them a voice.
If non-historians walking around today know the name Philip Schuyler, they know him as like the mostly absent father of Angelica and Eliza and Peggy in Hamilton, right?
Yeah.
But he ended up having this really significant role in 1775 in kind of an ill-conceived campaign to take over Canada. What was that about?
Yeah, ill-conceived is generous. Yeah, one of the first things we do after the rebellion begins, a revolution that supposedly is about ensuring basic rights and a defensive war, we mount an invasion of Canada. Schuyler is one of the wealthiest men in America. He's got great land holdings in New York State. He's very influential as a politician. He's got some military experience, and so he's made a general, and he will command this two-pronged invasion. Part of it goes up Lake Champlain. Schuyler is not a healthy man. He's suffering from malaria and other illnesses, and so he's got a subordinate named Richard Montgomery, who'd been a British Army officer, and he actually leads the invasion in, and they capture Montreal. And then the other prong of the invasion is going through the Maine wilderness, Maine then still part of Massachusetts, in the late winter, about 1,000 men led by Benedict Arnold, who's, you know, he's the finest combat leader on either side for the first 2 years of the war. He's a man born to lead other men in the dark of night. And it's one of the great treks in military history, Arnold reaching Quebec. It goes badly. The sickness sets in, and the Americans, take all of British-occupied Canada except for Quebec, which is a substantial fortress. The decision is made that it needs to be attacked. This is done on the last day of 1775. Montgomery, the leader of the expedition, is killed. Arnold is shot through the knee. Many of the Americans are either killed or captured. It all goes south. And our attempt to make Canada the 14th colony. We've tried blandishment, we've tried coercion, we've tried to convince them that they're not interested, particularly once they see that we're not strong enough to take it by force. And the British are going to send a large expedition, a punitive expedition, really, to finish driving us out of Canada in 1776, and then threaten New York. And this is an important part of what's happening in 1776.
It's really interesting to think about George Washington training as a military commander with the British.
Yes. You know, it's important, I think, to know that he spent 5 years in uniform. He was a militia colonel in Virginia, always under superior British command. He had a lot of combat experience, a lot of it bad. He was with General Braddock, his British commander, when Braddock was ambushed and killed near current-day Pittsburgh. Washington took 4 bullets through his uniform, escaped without a scratch otherwise. And then he retires basically to Mount Vernon, and he tends to his life as a gentleman planter, and he marries the richest widow in Virginia, Martha Dandridge Custis, and becomes a member of the Continental Congress. And 1775 rolls around, and he is the man with enough military experience, a Virginian who's going to be put in charge of a largely New England, largely Massachusetts Continental Army.
That's a bad cultural fit,
I should say. You know, and yes, it is a bad cultural fit because he's very disparaging of New Englanders. He writes about dirty New Englanders. He has nothing good to say about the junior officers from Massachusetts. He's really sneering about them. And he recognizes, he arrives in Cambridge outside of Boston when the British are besieged in Boston, July 2nd, 1775. He knows very little about artillery, about cavalry, about logistics or a continental force. There's a lot he does not know, and he has been out of uniform for more than 16 years. So there's a steep learning curve. He brings a stack of books on basically how to command an army. It's not maybe not what you're looking for in your commander-in-chief. And he's got some attitude issues to resolve because he does have this disparaging patrician look toward these New Englanders. He is appointed in part as an experiment in continental governance. Virginian and New Englanders, you put them together and you're hoping that there's going to be some American identity that emerges from this. But it's going to take him a while to figure out both how to be a successful commanding general and, I think even more important, how to be a leader. There is a mystical bond between leader and led. And he has to know the man who has 200 slaves back at Mount Vernon and overseers taking care of business for him while he's away at war. He has to know what the sacrifice involves for a yeoman farmer or a shopkeeper to leave their families and come serve at his side in the Continental Army. And they have to know that he knows in his bones the sacrifice. And that takes a while for it to develop. They have to go through, defeats and vicissitudes and agony and the occasional victory before they're really welded together as the indispensable institution, the army, and the indispensable man. And they're together going to be the long pole in the tent of the emerging republic.
Were there things he learned from his mistakes as a military commander that made him a better president?
I think so. I think he learned, for one thing, he learned the importance of, he has a pretty good eye for subordinate talent, for example, mm-hmm. and he sharpens that as a military commander. So, for example, he identifies an overweight Boston bookseller named Henry Knox, 25 years old, who shows up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and knows something about gunnery because he's been in the militia. He knows a little bit about engineering. And who knew that he's going to be the father of American artillery? He's absolutely got a genius for gunnery. Or Nathaniel Greene, a slightly pudgy Rhode Island Quaker anchorsmith who shows up, very little military experience, and Washington somehow intuits and acts on his intuition that this is going to be one of the great military leaders in American military history. So I think learning that subordinate talent is a critical part of leadership, Henry Knox will later serve as Secretary of War when President Washington is in office. He also learns he has imposed the concept of the civilian control of the military, that he is subordinate to his civilian masters, particularly the Congress. He's making this up as he goes along. This is a fraught subject because 18th century men, women are very aware of Oliver Cromwell and the dangers of dictatorship and a man on horseback who can basically take over the country. And they're very wary of Washington as a consequence. They're wary of any powerful military man. Right from the get-go, right from the first week that he becomes commander-in-chief, he writes deferential letter after deferential letter to the Congress, to colonial, later state governors. It's a great gift that he's given to us. And he takes that into the presidency with him, the notion that there is a hierarchy and that civilian control is paramount when it comes to your military. So there's a lot of things that he learns both personally and sort of institutionally that I think serve him well.
Would Southern colonists have say they were have said they were fighting for the same things as New England colonists?
I think generally with some nuances, you know, slavery, let's remember there are 2.5 million people living in the 13 colonies in 1775, and 500,000 of them were black slaves. The colonial militias in places like South Carolina have been established, and they're pretty rigorous, and they've got some military capability, and they have been established largely not to repel invaders from Britain or Spain or wherever, but to act as a force that can quash slave rebellions. So this is the way of life that they are fighting to protect. You know, the fine notions in the Declaration of Independence about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, these truths that we hold to be self-evident, by the way, they don't apply to black slaves, they don't apply to women, they don't apply to Native Americans, they don't apply to indigents, they're aspirational. So they would subscribe, the Southerners would subscribe to those ideas also, but when the British, for example, Lord Dunmore, who's the royal governor of Virginia, he decides that he is going to free the slaves of loyalists who rally to the British cause if those slaves come and take a musket and fight on behalf of the British. Nothing enrages George Washington, Patrick Henry, other Southern slaveholders as much as this measure. It really is it backfires on Dunmore and the British, and it is it's a rallying point for Southerners in particular. So, yeah, they're fighting for the same thing, but there are some important nuances, I think, in understanding that, you know, South Carolina is almost a foreign country compared to Massachusetts or New Hampshire. The New Englanders refer to Southerners. That's everybody who lives from New York south.
Right.
So understanding their mindset and understanding that they're not welded together as a country yet, that's part of what the Revolution is about, is important to understand how difficult it is for them to march in lockstep.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. When you talk about not being welded together as a country yet, there's the famous ride of Paul Revere, and the poem says that he cries, "The British are coming." People would have thought, "What do you mean?" if he'd said that.
Yes, right? Yes. Yeah, he did not say that. He probably, and he's quoted as saying, "The regulars are coming out," meaning the regular British Army. I use the title, "The British Are Coming," because that's really what the book is about. The first 2 years of the war is the British are sending the largest expeditionary force they have ever dispatched from the British Isles, with a majority of the British Army, with a very substantial part of the Royal Navy. It's the greatest navy the world has ever seen. They're hiring 30,000 German mercenaries, Hessians we call them, and they're coming to destroy your towns, to rape your women, to quash this rebellion, and it's a fearsome thing. It's you know, about as nasty as it gets, and if you know that this very substantial British force is coming, it really causes you to think twice about what it is that you're fighting for, what it is that you're willing to die for, what it is that you think you're going to get out of this in the long run.
Were fresh British troops that were sent to the colonies, were they diminished by the length of time that they spent on the passage across the Atlantic?
Sometimes, yeah. The age of sail is a terrible thing when you've got to cross 3,000 miles of open Atlantic. So it's not unusual going from west to east for ships to take 3 or 4 weeks to reach Britain. Going the other way against the prevailing winds from east to west, it can take 6 weeks. It can take 3 or 4 months. If you have bad luck and you hit storms, you can get blown to the West Indies. This is quite common. And if you have troop ships, that's a dire passage. Scurvy, typhus, which sometimes is known as ship fever because it's spread by lice on men in close quarters. It takes a pretty substantial toll. And so when those reinforcements arrive, they're often in bad shape. They've been on ships for a long time. The Germans who are sent over, in some cases, they have a fairly high mortality rate. It's even worse on horses. William Howe, the commanding general of the British force in New York when they arrive in summer of 1776, he asked for 950 horses because you need horses to pull your artillery wagons and to pull your supply wagons and so on. Well, the British send him 950 horses. 412 of them die in the passage across the Atlantic.
Wow.
There are horse carcasses all the way across, and scores more arrive in New York, and they're so enfeebled that they're useless. So the British underestimate the difficulties involved in waging expeditionary warfare across 3,000 miles of open ocean in the age of sail. They have all kinds of problems with supplies, provisions. They can't venture out of Boston or New York to gather provisions and fodder for their horses without getting ambushed. And so almost everything that they're consuming has to come from British or Irish ports.
Just getting that much food, whether you source it locally or from abroad, you know, before modern technology just seems like an extraordinary challenge.
It is an extraordinary challenge. Expeditionary warfare is always hard, whether it's Central Asia in the 21st century or North America in the 18th century. So in New York, the British force needs about 1,000 tons of bread a day. 1,000 tons a month. It usually arrives from Ireland, and it's infested with Irish rats. And soon there are Irish, and there's no rat nastier than an Irish rat. And soon the rats are infesting storehouses on Staten Island. It's a perpetual problem for them.
My guest is historian Rick Atkinson, former senior editor at the Washington Post. His new book is called The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. If you want to join us, call 800-933-5372. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian Rick Atkinson. We're talking about his new book, The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. You can join us at 800-933-5372. I want to go back to something that you said, which is that expeditionary warfare is always a challenge. The American rebel forces at least had the sort of home court advantage. How much could they, to what extent was their victory about just holding the British at bay?
Yeah, I think in general, when you're playing on your home court, the strategic necessity is not to lose. Whereas in this case, the British have to win. Mm-hmm. So Washington's biggest challenge is not to lose. If he can keep things neutral and avoid catastrophic defeat, which is what he does for 8 years, then you're ahead of the game, and the objective is to wear out the other guy and to cause them to lose heart, or they lose heart at home. This is the essence of an insurgency. you know, even though they're playing on their home court, they have tremendous logistical problems. So, for example, you can't move anywhere in the 18th century as an army unless you have salt. You need salt to salt your meat and your fish in order to feed your armies. You can't rely on fresh provisions. And so we were importing 15 million bushels of salt before the revolution. Half of it came from the West Indies, the other half from Britain and Southern Europe. When the revolution begins, the British impose an embargo, and two-thirds of that salt supply disappears. So there are recipes in newspapers, and pamphlets are put out on how to make salt. And there are great efforts along the Atlantic seaboard to make salt, and smuggling becomes a big deal. The price of salt goes from 2 shillings a bushel to 75 shillings a bushel. You can go down the list. Gunpowder. Washington is constantly obsessed with gunpowder. He just calls it the thing. It's so important to him. You know, there's a long list of combat necessities that are required. Even if you're at home, even if you have the substantial support of the people among whom you're fighting, that make this kind of warfare very complicated and very difficult.
So a war is expensive when you wage it far away. And you note the influence of British newspapers. People within Britain were not universally supportive of the way the colonists were treated before the war and the fact that Britain went to war against them after that.
Yeah, that's true, Chris. There's a substantial minority, and it is a minority, in Britain, both in Parliament and in the people as a whole, among 11 million Britons, who are sympathetic to the colonists, who are sympathetic to colonial aspirations, who don't like the king, who don't like they particularly don't like the ministries that the king has set up. And it remains a minority, really, for most of the war, until almost the very end, when things go against the British Army militarily in 1781. But it's a thorn in the side of those trying to prosecute the war because, among other things, there's a nattering press. It's a free press in Britain, and they can be extraordinarily harsh, cruel, really, in their criticisms of the war. And then there's a nattering minority in Parliament, and it includes some extraordinary voices like Edmund Burke, one of the great orators in the history of parliamentary government, Chatham, who's the great hero of the Seven Years' War, and he's old and somewhat enfeebled now, but he's still a lion in denouncing this foolish expeditionary effort to crush the rebels. So if you're George III, and particularly if you're Lord North, who's his prime minister, he's running the Parliament at this time, this is part of the landscape that you're dealing with. It's a complex, difficult issue to try to negotiate as you, first of all, ask for the money required, and it is very, very expensive. You ask for the men, and that's very expensive, too, in blood and treasure. And you ask for the country to remain steadfast, even though the war's not going nearly as well as you hope it will.
So anybody listening who has an ancestor who might have fought and died in the Revolutionary War on either side, it's more likely that ancestor died of disease than of a wound, right?
Yes. We think that at least 25,000 Americans died in the cause during the Revolution. Could be many more. There's some scholars who think it could be as high as 38,000. It's a higher proportion of the population than in any of our wars other than the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And you can group them into three batches: those who die of battle wounds, who are shot or otherwise killed in battle, and those who die of disease, smallpox, dysentery. It's a long list. And it's a larger proportion, larger fraction than those who die in battle. And then the third group is those who die in British prisons. The British capturing, for example, 3,000 men at Fort Washington, November 16th, 1776, a terrible catastrophe for Washington and the Americans. And most of those men end up dying in British prisons because of neglect. We would consider it a war crime today, the way that they are maltreated. kept in some cases on prison scows, ships anchored in the East River, and fed very little, in horrid conditions, dying in droves, tossed over the side of the ships into the East River rather than given even decent burial. So, disease is a terrible thing. Smallpox. Washington had had smallpox as a young man on a visit to Barbados. He's got small scars on his cheeks, which is telltale of smallpox. But once you've had it, you're immune. And that's really important. And we find that soldiers who have had smallpox are highly valued because smallpox, the king of terrors, as it was known, is a horrible thing when it gets in an encampment. At that point, they don't know that you can use cowpox to immunize people. The methods for avoiding smallpox are pretty crude at the time, and so disease is the greatest killer of armies in the 18th century.
Were they using germ warfare?
The British had used it against the Indians in the French and Indian War. They sent blankets infected with smallpox to them. The Americans suspected in Boston, for example, that the British were trying to do this. It's not clear that they were. In several instances, they expelled from Boston people who were either infected with smallpox or were in danger of being infected with smallpox because their relatives had smallpox. And Washington and others assumed that what the British were doing was trying to spread smallpox through the population and particularly through the army. When the British evacuated Boston in the middle of March 1776, the first force that Washington sent in to check out the evacuated, now liberated town of Boston, all those men had had smallpox because Washington was afraid that the British had left behind tainted blankets or other pathogens to infect his army.
All right, I want to go to the phones. Our number is 800-933-5372. First up is Rodolfo in Houston. Hi, Rodolfo.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm really blown away by this conversation. I got a lot of history lessons in public school here through movies. So I know, they showed us The Patriot, The Crossing, and various movies, mm-hmm. with John Wayne. And so is there any movie out there that might be somewhat accurate? The only one I know that's fake is the one with Will Smith called Independence Day, of course.
Thanks for your call, Rodolfo. Are there movies that you like about this time period?
I have to say no. There's a TV show called Turn that a lot of people like. I've seen just fragments of it. I can't say that I can endorse it. It's dramatic. There's some good things to say about the acting and so on. But for me, as a historian, I'm looking for things that are grounded firmly in history. You know, the greatest thing that has happened to the American Revolution lately is Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton, which is, it plays fast and loose with the truth, but it's a work of genius. And anybody who sees it and is interested in the revolution, great. I think that's fantastic. And it's a great way to bring to particularly a younger generation the idea. First of all, some of the characters who are fabulous and some of the ideas about which the revolution, around which the revolution was built. So, I would say if you're looking for something, tickets are pricey and they're hard to get, but if you're looking for an education through some mainstream entertainment, I would look first to Hamilton.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. When you're interacting at this granular level of detail, which is one reason I'm really drawn to your writing, is because there is so much detail that makes you relate as a person. But you have to be coming up, to that friction point between the myth that we've created about the American Revolution and the reality. Historians often talk about trying to overturn the myth, but is it important to us somehow?
Well, the myth is important. The myth is important to our identity, and to believe that we are fundamentally a virtuous people and that we have right on our side, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's also important, I think, to understand the reality and the truth and the foundation, to realize that we are a pugnacious, aggressive people, that we were born bickering, that disputation is in the national genome. And I think that's important. And when we today, when it seems that we can't agree on anything, it's important to recognize that this is part and parcel of who we are. The mythology of the revolution includes the notion that we're basically the aggrieved party in all cases. And I think understanding the British point of view, understanding that we did invade Canada and we were an aggressor at times, and that we did commit atrocities, and that it was a civil war. This is a very important aspect of it, that it really foreshadows the civil war of the 19th century, and it's as nasty as civil war can be. If you were a loyalist, you were in danger of having very aggressive rebel neighbors expropriate your property, put you in jail. There were loyalists who were lowered by windlass 70 feet below ground in Connecticut into an abandoned copper mine in Connecticut, known simply as hell. Exile, death, sometimes executions. So civil wars can be really nasty, and that is part of the landscape of the American Revolution. It's an important part of it. There were loyalist military units that were formed, quite a few of them actually, that fought with the British. So knowing the nuances of the revolution is important, I think, to understand, first of all, what we achieved against all odds in some cases, but also, you know, what came out of it, and the fact that there were costs there, and there are moral costs. The fact that, you know, the extermination of the Indians accelerates during the revolution. We take the opportunity to punish the Cherokee in a substantial way, for example, in on the Carolina frontier. And then let's not forget the 500,000 black slaves who are kind of the backbone of the Southern economy at the time, to help the Southern economy to weather 8 years of warfare. So it's a complicated moral terrain that we're talking about.
So in some ways, we know what comes next in the next volume of this trilogy. And yet, surely you've found some things that you want to highlight that aren't necessarily common knowledge. Will you share with us what you're planning?
Well, this book ends with the battles at Trenton and Princeton, late 76, early 1777, when things look very dark. Washington writes to his brother and says, I think the game is pretty near up. He's down to 3,000 men in the army, and then he has this desperate brainstorm.
3,000 men.
Yeah, 3,000 men. It's a country of 2.5 million people, and he's got an army of only 3,000 men. And a lot of them don't have shoes, and they're badly armed, and it is desperate. And so he crosses the Delaware River and attacks Hessian, the German garrison in Trenton, and defeats them, routs them, and then does it again. He crosses the Delaware again and gulls the British into attacking him in Trenton and inflicts substantial casualties, and then in the night slips around the British flank and attacks the rear guard in Princeton and destroys it. And so we're going to pick up the subsequent volumes at that point, and there's a lot that happens because it becomes a global war. The French come into it, the Spanish come into it, the Dutch come into it.
The new book by historian Rick Atkinson is The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. Rick, fascinating stuff. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Well, thanks for making time for me, Chris.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think and subscribe to our podcast using your favorite podcast app. If you want to learn about upcoming shows, check the website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.